Time for Magnuson Nature News, a monthly program about the amazing nature inside Magnuson Park. Each month will have a different theme featuring one of the animals or plants that lives here in the park. You'll hear fascinating facts, true nature stories that happened in the park, and the best places inside Magnuson Park to find our featured animal or plant of the month, and much, much more. Magnuson Nature News is brought to you by Magnuson Children's Garden, a great place for the whole family to visit together during any month of the year, and where all our events are free. I'm your host, Emily Bishton, and if you're one of the thousands of kids and parents who've met me over the past 15 years at Magnuson Children's Garden, or while I was working at Magnuson Community Center Nature Programs, the Jane Addams or Sandpoint Elementary School Garden Programs, or from any school who has come to Magnuson for a field trip, I want to give you a special welcome. This month's show is all about dragonflies and damselflies. But instead of me telling you all kinds of fascinating facts about them, I have a very special guest for this month's show. He is one of the world's foremost experts on dragonflies and damselflies, which are in the scientific family called Odonata. His name is Dennis Paulson, and besides knowing so much about Odonata, he is an expert on birds of all kinds, especially shorebirds. Dennis Paulson has written dozens of scientific papers, at least 7 books, and was the director of the Slater Museum of Natural History at the University of Puget Sound for many years. I feel very lucky to have been one of his students through the Seattle Audubon Master Birder Program and to have kept in touch with him in all the years since to learn more about dragonflies and damselflies, too. Dennis has been studying the Odonata in the Magnuson Wetlands ever since the first wetlands were built in 2009, and I am very happy to have him here today as my guest on the radio. Welcome, Dennis, to Magnuson Nature News Radio Show. Thank you so much for being my special guest.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Great. The first question I have for you, because you are such an amazing expert on dragonflies and damselflies, is what do you think are some of the most fascinating facts about these creatures?
Well, boy, there sure are a lot of them. I could probably spend all day talking about them, but I'll restrict myself to certain things that I think are really special in no particular order, I guess. Their vision is spectacular. They probably have the best vision of any insects, and they certainly have it all over us in some aspects of their vision in terms of resolution. A dragonfly can be sitting on a reed and see another dragonfly over it at so high that I can't see it with my binoculars and immediately fly up toward it. They catch tiny, tiny insects of a millimeter or two in size that are flying by, again, 30 or 40 feet away. They detect them amazingly. They can see much into many more wavelengths than we can. They can see well into the ultraviolet. They can detect polarized light, one of the ways they find water bodies, all kinds of things we can't do. Their brain is a tiny, tiny insect brain, but it's amazingly precise. And the neurons are so rapid when it comes to prey capture. Their brain is just, and neurons are just totally set up to detect movement, and as are their eyes. Their multifaceted eyes are, especially all insects, are especially good at detecting movement. And so a small critter flies by, and the dragonfly not only detects it immediately, but actually is able to lead it. Like a hunter leading a duck flying over with a shotgun. They actually fly not to where the insect is, but to where the insect will be at the time they intersect with it. Very, very cool. And powering all this is their two pairs of wings. Their flight, again, is probably the most diverse and effective of any insects at all. The four wings beat independently of one another, and this allows them to do all kinds of things, accelerate really rapidly, turn on a dime, stop suddenly. All the wings can be rotated, so there's just so many different combinations to allow them to fly very, very effectively, to capture their prey and to escape their predators. Some of them are on the wing for not just hours, but for days at a time. They're long-distance migrants that fly across the Indian Ocean and probably other places that we don't know about. One species called a wandering glider has been found on ships 1,000 kilometers from land, and they've actually, there's been some radar studies showing huge numbers of dragonflies migrating even at night, so they're amazing in that. Their metamorphosis is one of the really fantastic things about them. They live in the water as larvae, almost all of them, and they grow as a larva for some weeks or months or even years. And then when time comes to change into an adult, they don't do it like a butterfly does. A butterfly, as a larva, basically stops growing and forms a pupa or chrysalis, and within that chrysalis totally dissolves most of its body tissues and reconstitutes them around certain clumps of cells to become the adult butterfly, which then emerges from the pupa. A dragonfly does this inside the larva, basically. The larva is changing to an adult within it as it forages, as it wanders around the wetland, and at some point that change has become pretty much complete, and so the larva can't feed anymore because the adult mouth parts have withdrawn within the larval mouth parts, and it then starts breathing air coming to the surface a little bit, and then all of a sudden, bang, it comes out of the water, climbs up some stalk of some sort, and splits the skin and emerges as an adult dragonfly. So really, really different than the way a butterfly or a bee or a beetle does it.
I really didn't understand that until now about how that change is able to happen.
It's a wonder of nature for sure. Another thing about dragonflies is their coloration. Lots of insects have pretty colors, but I think dragonflies have taken it to an extreme, especially the adult males, many of which are territorial and sort of defend territories against other males, have gone to all the colors of the rainbow, and not only solid colors, but in combination. There are blue and red dragonflies and green and red and black and yellow and orange and purple and just an amazing array of color combinations. Many of them have iridescence on their bodies. The wings of many of them are colored in all sorts of bright patterns, just about an infinity of color patterns, many of which are functional. They're used in courtship or displays. So a very, very cool thing.
That iridescence that you talked about on their wings, where they're just like this gold, it's flashing in the sky, and it's just so beautiful to see that.
Take a trip to Southeast Asia and look at some of the damselflies there that have the upper wings, well, the upper hind wings, brilliant, brilliant metallic green. And when they open their wings and fly around a stream, you have these flashes of metallic green one after another as the wings open and close. And there's one in South Central America, which I just saw last week in Costa Rica, that has the whole upper wings brilliant metallic blue. And watching one of those fly around is just, it's like a little piece of the sky came down to the pond.
Yeah. And I would imagine that, you know, if for a birder, that one of the things that you might get fooled and think that it's a hummingbird.
Sure.
Because if the wings are so vibrant and colored.
Yeah, and of course, many dragonflies are quite a bit bigger than hummingbirds.
Yeah, wow.
I didn't say anything about their predatory abilities beyond just their ability to track something in flight. Dragonflies eat other dragonflies as large as themselves. Three species have been known to take hummingbirds. There's all sorts of amazing things about their predatory habits, too. Yeah.
I had no idea they could take on creatures.
Yeah. Thank goodness they don't get to be 6 feet long.
Yeah, and swoop us up. Yeah, for sure. So I'm curious also about all the work that you've done at the Magnuson Park Wetlands to keep track of the populations of dragonfly and damselflies there. When did you start visiting the wetlands to do that, and why?
When and why? I started in May 2010 after I heard about all the work that had been done there creating all those ponds. It's only about 20 minutes from my house, and I was very excited to go see what dragonflies were there, because there aren't a lot of places in Seattle that are really great for dragonflies. And it turned out that Magnuson was one of them. It was full of dragonflies when I first got there. And so I basically decided to conduct an ongoing survey just because these were new ponds, and it was very exciting to see what, you know, how the dragonfly populations would work there. And again, when I say dragonfly, I'm always including damselfly. So I started in May 2010, and I've tried to go once a week through the entire summer right up into early November every year since then. So that's been 7 years, or eight years. This summer would make it 9 years, and I'll talk about that a little later. And it's been a wonderful experience to do that, and I definitely plan to write a paper about it at some point when I'm finished with several other projects.
That's wonderful. When you first started going there in 2010, I'm curious about what the populations were like in those first few years and then what they're like now.
Sure. When I first went there, I would say about 15 species were common. I mean, they'd already, I think maybe less than a year, or maybe in the first summer after the ponds were dug, they were already full of Odonata. 15 species were common then. Some of them have subsequently disappeared as the habitat has changed. Some others have added into the mix. And so I would say, you know, around 20 species are the normal number that are there all summer. Between me and several other of my friends who go over there, we've seen 26 species over this period of year. Five of them only once or twice. Just obviously just vagrants from somewhere else, not established populations. There's been major changes, was a pattern all throughout. I mean, within a couple of years, I could see species being added that were more characteristic of, say, more vegetated wetlands. So as the vegetation grew up in these ponds, these species found them more to their liking, or maybe they just, you know, didn't get there until then. So populations went up really nicely for a while. But then some kind of bad things happened for the dragonflies just in the past few years. First, pied-billed grebe started nesting there. And it turns out that one of the major food that pied-billed grebes eat and feed to their young are the larvae of damselflies and dragonflies. And I've watched quite a few grebe nests over the years, and there's no question that the majority of what they bring in are darner larvae and damselfly larvae, the same species that were very common in these ponds. And all of these things have declined rather substantially in that period. Second thing that happened was fish became introduced into the pond, the shore lagoon, the pond closest to Lake Washington, and somehow spread from there into other ponds. So they're now in quite a few of the ponds. And they also, of course, eat dragonfly larvae and sometimes even the adults. And so that's another thing that's caused a kind of overall decline. And then finally, the 1-2-3 punch, the management of Magnuson Park has been anti-dragonfly. From year one, I talked to people at the park about this and treated them to think about what I was saying, but they really never have. The growth of woody vegetation has pretty much closed in a lot of the wetlands. And what dragonflies and many other wetland species need is sun. And so when the trees grow up and shade the ponds, they immediately become less valuable for dragonflies and quite a few other wetland creatures. So this is sort of general. And the other change, of course, that happened is while this was happening, I became less and less able to survey these ponds. At first, they were pretty much mostly open, and I could go to any part of the shore and, you know, look at dragonflies and see what was there. Now, this summer, when I went there, I've been there a couple times, and I can't even get to most of the ponds anymore. I have to have a machete to do so, and of course they're bounded by Himalayan blackberry and roses, stuff you don't just lightly walk through. Right. Even if I was willing to bushwhack through there, you almost can't anymore. Finally, the best pond of all was the shore lagoon, and that's the one that was hit first by grebes and fish, and now the beaver dams have flooded the walkway around the partway around that pond. The only single open area left in all the ponds that I could actually look at dragonflies from.
Mm-hmm.
So this year was just to me a total disaster, and I'm pretty much stopping my study because it's just not relevant anymore. Mm-hmm. So it makes me kind of sad.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I'm curious about a couple things that you said. One is there's the growing up of all the trees and shading the ponds. Does that make the temperature lower, and does that affect the?
No, I don't think so. I think it's the adult dragonflies need sun.
Okay, so the adults are just not even bothering to.
Yeah, they just don't like it there anymore. And then the shore vegetation, the shallow shore zone that may have emergent vegetation, it gets shaded out, and that lowers the productivity there from the plant level on up. And so that's just another bad thing.
I don't understand why rushes are not as plentiful in a lot of the ponds as they used.
Yeah, some have just gotten completely shaded. I never see dragonflies in them at all anymore.
Mm-hmm. And do the pygill grebes themselves, the adults, eat the larva, or is it primarily something that they feed to their young?
No, they eat them themselves also.
Okay, God.
And they even catch the adults. I've seen them catching adult common green darners that came down to the shore to lay eggs. A grebe just grabs one by the wing and eventually swallows it.
Yeah.
Are there any other birds? I like grebes, and it's a shame that they alone seem to have played a pretty substantial part in the decline of dragonflies here, but probably the introduction of fish, centrarchids like largemouth bass and pumpkin seeds, all of which eat lots of dragonfly larvae, just made it that much worse.
Right. And I know that it was very soon after I first saw fish in the shore pond that I started seeing more grebes there.
And of course they're eating the fish too.
And then they just stayed for the dragonfly banquet.
You know, the other thing the grebes eat are those oriental weatherfish, as you know. Oddly, I have never seen a grebe bring in a young bass or sunfish to its nest. But they catch lots of the weatherfish, which, I don't know, maybe they can catch them more easily. And the weatherfish, I don't think, eat very many Udineta larvae. I think it's the bass and the sunfish that eat more of those.
Okay. Yeah, the weatherfish are the ones that I've seen way in, even in the little, what they call the rice paddy ponds, the little.
They can travel over land and when it's very wet, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sad to me too that the dragonfly population has declined so much, and I can only hope that some things will change with the way it's managed.
Yeah. One example is a straightforward is the tule bluette, the little blue damselflies that are at all the ponds. It was by far the most abundant odonate at those ponds for years. Mm-hmm. When I was at the shore lagoon a week ago, I couldn't find one.
Really?
They were there by the hundreds, if not thousands, for years. And
definitely
one of the
ones I used to, I would teach kids about identifying that. And, of course, the green darner and the eight-spotted skimmer. But I didn't realize that the tule bluettes were so uncommon there compared to the way they were, because they were everywhere.
Yeah, and interestingly, eight-spotted skimmers are still very common. Their larvae are burrowing, and so they may be immune to some of that predation just because they're in the mud.
They burrow down in the mud.
Yeah.
Oh, that could be, because that was certainly the times I've been in the wetlands this year, that has certainly been the most abundant dragonfly.
They're doing very well, and I think it has to be because of the larval habitat.
Well, so on another note, another question I have about it is, what would you say would be the rarest species that you've ever seen at Magnuson in years past?
I guess probably the is a dragonfly called a spot-winged glider, which is more of a tropical and southern species, which comes up to Washington every summer in very small numbers. And I've seen a couple of them at the Magnuson Pond, so that's always fun when you see one. I don't even see them every year. And then I've seen two species of meadowhawks, one of them black, one of them red, at the ponds that are basically eastern Washington species, and they just wandered over here, a couple of individuals. And so it was, again, really fun to see them, but they're not part of the community.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that you, some of the from summer all the way pretty deep into fall is when you've done your monitoring.
Yeah, they start, the first damselflies start emerging in late April, weather permitting, and you know we don't have the greatest springs around here, so it's a pretty slow development of the populations even through May. Usually by June, there's a lot of stuff around. I would say late June through August would be maybe a peak. July and August are certainly the peak months for dragonflies in Washington, and I would say the same at Magnuson.
Great.
But at the same time, some of the darners and meadowhawks are very late flyers, and I've routinely seen them into the first week or so of November when the weather stays good.
Wow. And do the green darners here, do they migrate?
Yes, they do. They appear in the spring from the south somewhere, we don't know where, and lay their eggs and breed and lay their eggs, and those larvae develop in the summer and emerge sometime around August usually, and pretty much leave the area and fly south. That's sort of what we've put together over the years. We certainly don't know the good details on it, but that seems to be what must be happening.
That is so amazing.
Yeah, wonderful.
So do you have a favorite species of dragonfly or damselfly? I know you've seen them all over the world, and just wondering if you have a favorite or...
You know, I should. I have a favorite bird, but I don't. I've never developed a favorite dragonfly. I think it's because they're all so really, really neat and fascinating in their own ways. I have studied them on all the continents, and I guess I've seen somewhere maybe around a fifth of the 6,000-plus species that there are, and I've seen almost all the ones in North America, and yeah. I just... You know, when I look at any of them, I guess I'll have to admit the ones that you see less often are probably more favorite, because the really, really, really common ones that you see every day, it's a little hard for me to make them my favorites. But I really like a lot of different kinds. Yeah.
Yeah. I can certainly understand that. They have always been fascinating to me too, and even more so now that I've heard all the fascinating facts you shared about them. That is, yeah. Those are
there are good there
really
are good
cool.
books on dragonfly biology too. So that's, you know, if a person is more interested, you can look online even and find sort of like beginner's books on dragonflies.
Mm-hmm. I just recently bought your book, your identification guide to the Western dragonflies.
Uh-huh.
And I've been trying to teach myself you know, to be able to identify dragonflies in Arizona.
Sure.
While we're down there, since
there are a lot of them down there, even though it's a desert state somewhat, there's still lots of dragonflies.
Thank you very much for being our special guest. I learned so much about dragonflies and damselflies, and it makes me even more excited to learn more about how to identify the ones I see in the Magnuson wetlands. Thanks again for being our special guest.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
This month's true Magnuson nature story happened 2 or 3 years ago, right in the Magnuson wetlands. We were on a really fun nature hike at summer camp, and we stopped to look at the birds out in one of the ponds. And I reached out my arm to point my finger at something for everyone to look at, and all of a sudden, a damselfly landed right on my arm. And everybody was close to me, so we all got to see it. And as soon as we started looking closely, we noticed it was holding an aphid in its front legs. And do you know what that damselfly did? It bit the head off and ate it right in front of us. And then it ate the whole body of the aphid. While we were all watching. And then it kind of cleaned its head and face off. Just the way you see a dog or a cat sometimes do that, where they take their front paw and wash their face. That little damselfly did that too. And then it flew away. And all of us were just standing there with our mouth open. I wonder if that damselfly thought my arm was a branch of a tree, since I'd been holding it out and pointing for about 10 seconds before it landed. But no matter why it landed on my arm, I was so glad that everyone got to see how a damselfly holds its prey, how it eats it, and even how it washes up afterwards. And that damselfly was a Tule Bluet, one of the ones that Dennis mentioned in his interview. If you'd like to hear more dragonfly stories and damselfly stories, sign up for our e-newsletter by sending me an email at magnusandchildrensgarden@gmail.com, and I'll send you the August issue. Hope to see you in the park.